Ayatollah Khamenei calls for punishment of those behind the assassination of one of the country's top nuclear scientists. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says Tehran will respond to the terror attack targeting an Iranian nuclear scientist in due time. Thousands of people in Paris protest against police brutality and a proposed security bill, which contains provisions that rights groups say restrict media freedom. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Azia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran this hour, where the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for those involved in the assassination of the country's prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, to be brought to justice. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged relevant authorities to pursue the matter and mete out, quote, definitive punishment for those who ordered and perpetrated the crime. The leader said Fakhrizadeh was killed by criminal and ruthless mercenaries. Ayatollah Khamenei also called on officials to follow up on the technical and scientific activities of Fakhrizadeh in all sectors that he was working in. He further expressed his condolences on the martyrdom of this eminent scientist. The Iranian president says the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, shows the enemy's desperation in the face of Iran's scientific progress. Hassan Rouhani said the terrorist act also indicates the enemy's failures on political fronts in the region as well as across the world. He notes the assassination of the Iranian scientist also suggests to the extent of the enemy's malice and grudge toward the Islamic Republic. Rouhani reiterated that such terror attacks will not weaken Iranians' will to move on the path of scientific development. He also said that Iran will respond to this criminal act. Meanwhile, Tehran says there are serious indications of Israel's involvement in the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist and Deputy Defense Minister Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations made the comment in a letter to the world body's chief and the president of the UN Security Council. Majid Takhravanchi urged them to strongly condemn the assassination and to take the necessary measures against the perpetrators. He also warned against any U.S. and Israeli adventurism against his country. Takhravanchi said the Islamic Republic reserves the right to defend its people and secure its national interests.
The assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh has caused outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemy's desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said harsh revenge awaits the terrorist elements and all those behind the assassination. Chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hussein Salami, said retaliation and harsh punishment for the perpetrators are already on the agenda. Salami said the terrorist act was plotted and directed by the Israeli regime. In a tweet, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there were serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in a 2018 presentation by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where he repeated Tel Aviv's baseless allegations against Tehran's nuclear program.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The New York Times also quoted three intelligence officials as saying that Israel was behind the terrorist attack. Hossein Dehghan, a military advisor to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, said Israel is seeking to intensify pressure on Iran with the aim of provoking a full-fledged war. The former defense minister said Iran will descend like lightning on the killers of the country's scientists and will make them regret their actions. The head of the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights said Fakhrizadeh's assassination was aimed at hindering the country's scientific progress.
What is noteworthy from my point of view about the assassination attempt made today in Tehran was that there is a serious will by the Iranians' enemy to prevent the improvement and advancement of the Iranian people. They are going to put hurdles on our way.
Fakhrizadeh was also leading a team tasked with developing one of Iran's first kits for coronavirus diagnosis. The plot to assassinate him was not the first, as he had survived several such attempts in the past years. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under the intense scrutiny of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
The European Union has slammed as a criminal act the assassination of Iranian top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The EU said in a statement that the assassination runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights. Former director of the US CIA also described the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist as a highly reckless criminal act. John Brennan warned that Fakhrizadeh's murder risks lethal retaliation and a new round of regional conflict. United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions also said Fakhrizadeh's assassination is a violation of international human rights law.
An extraterritorial targeted killing outside an armed conflict is a violation of international human rights law prohibiting the arbitrary deprivation of life and a violation of the UN Charter prohibiting the use of force extraterritorially in times of peace.
Meanwhile, Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah condemned Fakhrizadeh's murder as a heinous attack sponsored by the U.S. and Israel. Hezbollah's deputy leader also stressed that the assassination was part of a war on Iran and the region. Sheikh Naim Qasem said that the response to the murder is in Iran's hands. Iraq's Association of Scholars also slammed the act of terror, accusing Israel's spy agency Mossad of being behind it. Yemen's Ansarullah and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement also condemned the attack. Political commentator Sambir Abu Mariam, says the assassination of Iranian top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is a violation of international law and human rights.
This is our loss. This is loss for Pakistan. This is loss for Iran. And especially, I would like to say, it is a great loss for Palestine and also the resistance. This act is the unlawful act and violation of international laws, violation of human rights, violation of international human rights laws. And also it is a highly criminal act which is unjustifiable at any level. This kind of covert attacks never go and put down to the Iranian nation and Iran, because United States and Israel, they want to put down Iranian development. At this time, they are again on the wrong side of the history. And Iran and the other nations of the world, they are standing with the people of Iran at this time, and they are standing with the resistance.
Iran has reported less than 400 coronavirus deaths for the first time in nearly a month. The health ministry spokeswoman Seema Saadatlari said the daily fatalities rose by 391, taking the total death toll to nearly 47,500. Lari also added that the number of daily infections rose by more than 13,000. That takes the total number of cases to nearly 936,000. Iranian government has implemented restrictions throughout the country to curb the spread of the virus. And now to France, where thousands of people have taken to the streets out in the capital, Paris, to demonstrate against police brutality and a new bill that would restrict sharing images of police. Demonstrators gathered at the city's Republic Square, holding effigies of the French president and the interior minister. They called for the abolition of the so-called global security draft law. Similar protests were held in the northern city of Lille, while a dozen more rallies were planned across the country. A controversial bill is awaiting Senate approval after it was passed by the National Assembly last week. Critics say that the legislation would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished. The rallies come after footage emerged showing French officers beating and racially abusing a black man, sparking widespread condemnation. Meanwhile, the British media say the Scottish First Minister wants to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. The first vote in 2014 saw a majority of Scots rejecting the independence bid, but recent polls indicate more and more people are now in favor of secession from the UK. Well, we discuss this issue in our news review program.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of News Review. British media say Scotland's First Minister is seeking to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. Madame Nicola Sturgeon has said she anticipates the vote will take place in the earlier part of the next Scottish Parliament. That term begins next year. Scotland held its first referendum on independence from Britain, if you recall, in 2014. 55% of voters said no, but 14 recent polls have shown a majority of Scots now support independence. Such sentiment has gained momentum following Britain's exit from the European Union. Widespread criticism over the British government's handling of the pandemic is contributed to. London is against a new referendum in the near future. It says the previous vote should be respected. And that's what we'll be discussing in this edition of News Review with guests who kindly join us from London. I have Amina Taylor. She's our correspondent in the British capital, as well as Mr. John White. He's an author and commentator who joins us via Skype out of Edinburgh itself. Guests, very good to have you with us. I'm going to begin with London and, you know, the sentiment against it and, you know, the fact that London says it's soon. Is it?
Well, Westminster would say that, wouldn't it? Because quite frankly, they would have seen how the wind is blowing in this particular scenario. I was one of the leading correspondents who went up for Press TV in 2011 when they were really pushing forward for even the right to be able to stage the referendum, because of course at that time the Conservative government was putting obstacles in place. This was just before Nicola Sturgeon's tenure here, and there were so many conversations about even if Holyrood had the right to demand the ability to ask its own people about what should happen in terms of taking their destiny on board. And I do remember the polling at that time, it was around 60-40, and even that was some improvement. So it was seen as a long shot. Now, fast forward to 2014, when I was also on location in Scotland in the weeks leading up to that referendum, it was close. But one of the fundamental things that actually swayed it in the direction of no for independence was the fact that Scotland would be seen to be moving away from the European Union, with the European Union saying, listen, we don't really like separatist situations as they don't for Catalonia and their bid for independence. So if you were to break away, well, you'd be pretty much on your own for a while. Well, they might not like to admit this, but the sands have shifted dramatically. You cannot have a Brexit scenario where Scotland overwhelmingly, I think about 56% of the total votes in Scotland, John might be able to correct me here on this, were definitely pro-EU. So you cannot have this situation where Westminster's pulling in one direction, Edinburgh's trying to pull in another, and the people of Scotland are trying to kind of be in that middle ground where London's calling the shots, but they're not respecting the wishes of those on the ground. I just don't see how this is tenable. I really don't.
Mm. John White in Edinburgh, of course, Amina made mention, and you know, true in that, you know, made mention of the issue of the Brexit scenario, and of course, you know, staying away from the European Union, not a favorable stance by the Scots. You're in Edinburgh yourself. Just tell us how the feeling, you know, back in 2011, 2014, there was no talk of Brexit, yet there was a referendum, and you know, so there are, it seems to me that there are, you know, factors above and beyond this issue of Brexit.
Well, the genie of Scottish independence is well and truly out of the bottle, and it's not going to be put back in again. The argument in favour of Scottish independence has been won. What's yet to take place is the political struggle by which to achieve it. I mean, it's absolutely correct. A main plank of the No campaign in 2014, the main argument was that if Scotland wanted to stay in the European Union, it would have to remain in the UK. And a lot of people were swayed by that argument. Nobody in their right mind would have believed that just 2 years later, in service to an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Rule Britannia was abroad and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased, that Britain would take this calamitous step of coming out of the largest free trading bloc in the world. And that's come to pass. So the game has changed. COVID has only accelerated the trend towards Scottish independence due to the shambolic handling of this virus by Westminster, opposed relative to Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, who's widely been perceived as being very competent and assured in her handling of COVID. So the argument's been won. The politics has been won in favour of Scottish independence. The UK is the very epitome of an artificial state. Different cultures, different histories, antagonistic in their relation to England for much of their histories, Ireland, Wales and Scotland. And so the linchpin of the British state, the UK, was an industrial working class that cohered around the common trade union struggles. But the UK no longer is an industrial nation and no longer has an industrial base. And so the different cultures, regional and national, have now come to the fore. And that's been reflected in the politics and the votes, i.e. in terms of the Brexit referendum, where Scotland actually, 62% of Scotland voted to remain. That translates to every single one of Scotland's 32 local authorities. So it's Scottish independence is an idea whose time has come, but it's only going to come on the back of a very fierce political struggle next year.
All right, guests, many, many thanks for joining us and discussing this with me. Amina Taylor, our correspondent in London, always well-informed and nice. John White, author and commentator from Edinburgh via Skype. I really appreciate the time you gave us this hour. Thank you for staying with us.
That brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for being with us.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The UK government has created a potentially unlawful blacklist of the names of people seeking information under the country's Freedom of Information Act, two investigative journalists have discovered. The names of charity workers, campaigners, and journalists have been entered on the list without their knowledge, in an apparent breach of the UK's privacy laws. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, which is published under the heading UK Government Blacklisted Journalists Over Freedom of Information Requests. Here is the details of this article. The UK government has created a potentially unlawful blacklist of the names of people seeking information under the country's Freedom of Information Act, two investigative journalists have discovered. The names of charity workers, campaigners, and journalists have been entered on the list without their knowledge in an apparent breach of the UK's privacy laws. Journalists working for Associated Press, Guardian, and other news organizations are known to have been placed on the list along with people working for Friends of the Earth, Privacy International, and other NGOs. It is thought that none of them have been informed. The discovery of the blacklist comes at a time when the British government is mounting efforts to stem the release of information under the Act. A recent survey conducted by the UK National Union of Journalists found that its members now believe the government's increasing disregard of transparency laws is a greater impediment to their work than the UK's notoriously stringent libel laws. British government departments are granting fewer and refusing more Freedom of Information Act requests than at any time in the law's 15-year history. The blacklist was discovered by Jenna Corderi and Peter Joincom, two journalists with the Open Democracy website. It is maintained within a unit known as Clearinghouse, located within the Cabinet Office, the department that supports the Prime Ministers and coordinates the work of government. The Cabinet Office initially refused to disclose the list, but the Information Commissioner's Office, which oversees the implementation of the Act, ordered it to do so. It includes applicants' names, which were redacted before the list was handed over, along with the names of their employers and details of their work. It is still refusing to disclose documentation relating to the list, including advice that it offers to other British government departments. It is planning to appeal to the courts against the Information Commissioner's ruling that more details of the clearinghouse operations should be made public. Requests for information under the Freedom of Information Act are supposed to be applicant blind, with government departments not discriminating for or against individuals who make them. The court that hears the Cabinet Office appeal may also rule on the legality of the clearinghouse operations, with some privacy law experts believing it may be declared unlawful. John Baines, a data protection advisor at London law firm Mishkan Doreya, said, "I am far from assured that the operation of the clearinghouse complies with data protection law. It appears to use a round-robin list by which FOI requesters' names are circulated around all government departments. Requesters would not normally have a reasonable expectation that their details would be so widely disclosed, and in most cases, it does not appear that they are informed that this will happen. Moreover, I suspect that most requesters would object to the breadth of this disclosure. Data protection law requires, as a basic principle, that personal data be processed fairly and in a transparent manner. On the evidence that I have seen, I do not feel that the clearinghouse meets these requirements, he added. Gavin Frigard, head of data and transparency at the Institute for Government, said that 15 years after the Freedom of Information Act came into effect, the public was still having to fight to access information, with delayed responses, more requests being rejected than ever before, and these reports of a clearinghouse, it feels like we are having to fight for the right to information all over again. And all this at a time when it's vital for politicians, the press and the public to be able to scrutinize government. A number of British politicians also expressed alarm at the discovery of the clearinghouse. David Davis, a Conservative former cabinet minister, said, "The whole purpose of the Freedom of Information Act was to increase transparency and accountability of government. To that explicit end, all requests are legally required to be treated independent of who the applicant is. This clearinghouse is certainly against the spirit of that act, and probably the letter too. Ministers should explain to the House of Commons precisely why they continue with this setup, in view of the fact that it is contradictory to the whole purpose of freedom of information." Helen Hayes, Shadow Cabinet Office Minister with the opposition Labour Party, said, "This is extremely troubling. If the Cabinet Office is interfering in FOI requests and seeking to work around the requirements of the Act by blacklisting journalists, it is a grave threat to our values and transparency in our democracy." The government minister heading the cabinet office, Michael Gove, has a history of attempting to undermine the effectiveness of the UK's Freedom of Information Act. In 2010, while education secretary, he was discovered to be sending emails through an account in the name of his wife. His advisors called this Mrs. Blair account. Gove's officials at the education department systematically destroyed correspondence, and his closest political advisor, Dominic Cummings, told colleagues that he would answer only those emails that came from personal accounts. The Information Commissioner concluded that the department should be subject to special monitoring to ensure that it complied with the law.
Africa Today.
Pirates are abducting bigger groups of seafarers in the Gulf of Guinea these days.
There has been a clear surge in the number of seafarers kidnapped by pirates so far this year, according to multiple reports by international observers.
Now, the latest global piracy report by the ICC International Maritime Bureau shows a 40% increase in the number of kidnappings reported in the Gulf of Guinea. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and I'd like to introduce our new colleague, Ms. Ibrahim Abdi Karim.
Hello, I am happy to be with you in the program. In this show, we will take you to the Gulf of Guinea, where over 90% of global kidnappings take place.
And in the second part of our show, we'll delve into how the Anglo-American PLC has caused widespread lead poisoning in Zambia for decades. Stay with us.
Gulf of Guinea piracy. Piracy and armed robbery, crimes notoriously reminiscent of the Gulf of Guinea, bordering more than 3,700 miles of West African coast between Guinea and Angola. Pirates and armed robbers operate off at least 8 countries in the Gulf of Guinea: Nigeria, Benin, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Togo, and Gabon.
We are currently working with them to transition production into those countries. And if Nigeria has a capability to manufacture specialized ribs, then the rest of the region should be supporting Nigeria in buying those vessels from Nigeria. And that way the region has the ability to establish a maritime ecostructure that'll feed off itself and work as one system.
The International Maritime Bureau sounded the alarm and called for international cooperation after tracking an unprecedented rise in kidnappings in the region in 2019, up to 50% from the previous year.
Piracy and criminality continue in this vast and strategically significant body of water despite some international efforts to contain the pirates. The criminal tactics of pirates and armed robbers are also evolving.
We are now joined by Dr. Okafor-Yar Wood, a maritime safety and security expert with a regional focus on the Gulf of Guinea, to listen to her view on how piracy in the Gulf of Guinea has transformed.
It is now more like an organized crime whereby there are groups. Elites are actually also represented in the system that are able to do the negotiation, that have access to perhaps offshore accounts where the ransom is paid, and then they're able to communicate to a different group that is able to confirm that the ransom has been paid. And then they also have people that work in the communities that have access to navigation skills and can actually accommodate without sometimes raising suspicion of who the people they are holding, you know, where these victims are usually kept. So it's currently, unfortunately, no longer just about economic marginalization, but it is now a full-blown business network that have different spheres and different categories of people involved.
Thanks for that, Dr. Okafor-Yar Wood, a maritime safety and security expert.
Oil tankers are often the targets of attacks, given the fact that the Gulf borders many African countries with sizable oil and gas industries. With the oil prices crashing in 2014, the pirates have shifted their tactics and preferred to kidnap seafarers for ransom instead of getting engaged in a complicated operation to steal oil. The shipping company or the hostages' families will have to pay ransom for the victims to be released. But the abducted captain, first mate, or chief engineer are not the only victims in this crime. Coastal communities suffer the dire consequences of piracy, and the most vulnerable sectors of the society are trapped in a cycle of crime and poverty.
The environment has also been polluted and degraded to the point that people, fishers, farmers that would usually make their living from farming or from fishing are no longer able to do so due to the level of pollution in the region. So, for example, the extensiveness of oil pollution in the Niger Delta, one of the highest or most polluted regions in the world or deltas in the world, is such that about 40% of the mangrove is oiled. And in the case of selected communities across the region, there are people that depend on, say, catching periwinkles, women primarily, from the mangroves that are no longer able to do that because of oil destruction.
The opportunistic criminal groups are motivated by profits and not politics. It's worth mentioning that the influx of multinational oil companies and the efforts to disrupt the exploitation of Nigerian oil has had its role to play in the creation of culture of piracy.
Now today, piracy goes beyond Nigeria to areas of the coast of Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, and the emerging hotspots of Togo and Benin.
Our radar system and our lookouts, we have the potential to see any threats that are approaching us, and, you know, miles out. So before any piracy issue would take place, we would have notification well in advance.
Now there are concerns that terrorist organizations such as Boko Haram or the Takfiri Daesh West African province could use the tactics employed by the pirates to pursue their extremist agenda.
After all, on the other side of the continent, Somali pirates have been accused of smuggling weapons and cargo for terrorists.
However, in 2013, regional heads of state of 25 Western Central African countries came together in Yaoundé, and they were able to agree and sign three strategic documents. They had a memorandum of understanding. They had the Yaoundé Code of Conduct, and also a political declaration that centers around issue of addressing holistically issues of maritime insecurity in the region. So I think it has gone beyond relying on colonial powers.
Piracy in the region also has a harsh impact on the environment. As pirates hastily load oil onto small and rudimentary vessels, spills could contaminate the Gulf, hurting fishing and other sources of food and livelihood. There are also concerns that the contamination could reach freshwater sources for drinking and farming. Yet piracy does not look like it is on the path to leave the region.
Last year, how many attacks did you do?
Last year, of course, I struck no less than 15 attacks, because we have nowhere to start from. Sometimes we hijack the ships to get money.
Usually, how much is it to release a ship?
Depends on the ship. We can even say 200 million, bring 900 million for.
And when you keep the member of the crews, you keep them on the ship, on the boat, or you will...
Sir, I've tried for you.
With the Gulf being unsafe, critical industries like fishing and tourism cannot thrive, leading to economic repercussions on the local populations. Cancer and asthma are also among the long-term health complications in such an environment. With the governments bringing in less revenue, the cost of living goes higher, causing more poverty and potentially more crime.
I think that some of the key reasons why the threat, and of course other illicit threats, is present in the region is primarily due to, you could say, economic hardship. You could say due to a sense of economic and political exclusion and economic marginalization, when people feel that they are sitting in the midst of plenty, but they are not necessarily benefiting from what is the resources that has been extracted from their region. And so it all began as a way of, all these things resulted in what I would call animosity against the state.
Since the COVID-19 pandemic has appeared, the situation has exacerbated in the Gulf. The rise in piracy attacks appears to correlate with the spread of the virus in January until global disconfinement in June.
Now, the rise in attacks is explained by the freeze in activities on the docks due to quarantining and a sharp decrease in income for already fragile shore populations.
What do you think about people doing maritime piracy? What is your opinion about this?
It's due to joblessness. After your years in school, can you go back home now? You don't have any work to do. What do you think will come to your mind? And you cannot go to the river and go fishing any longer again. So if you have any way to go there, you go and do piracy. If you die from there, well, it is the will of God. Let it be. So joblessness leads to this piracy.
Lack of resilience in the infrastructure of port security and a diminished ability to react to unexpected events like the spread of COVID-19 are among the factors increasing piracy.
So what should regional states do?
They should ensure that as they explore oil, for example, they should keep in mind that oil is not the only marine resources. They should take advantage of the potential coast, the potential of developing coastal tourism, for instance, investing in the fisheries sector, investing and ensuring that the collaboration and the cooperation that they are really putting so much effort on and emphasis sometimes on piracy and armed robbery at sea is also extended to issues of illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, because actually that also poses a very significant threat to the livelihood of the people.
Now, thanks a lot for that, Dr. Okafuri-Arwood, maritime security and safety expert, and we're all looking forward to an end of piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. And it's that time in our program where we bring you a collection of news and events from across Africa. What do you have today for us, Ekram?
Thank you, Henya. Today we've got six different news from different parts of Africa. And now, on to the first one. The Iranian documentary, No Place for Angels, won the Safinaz Foundation Special Award at the Kenya Film Festival. The documentary, No Place for Angels, directed by Sam Kalantari and produced by Hamid Shakibania and Mohsin Shah Mohammed Mirab, won the special award of the Safinaz Foundation. Ethiopia's Tigray crisis. Rocket hit outskirts of Eritrea's capital. The leader of Ethiopia's Tigray region has confirmed the firing of missiles at neighboring Eritrea's capital and is threatening many more, marking a huge escalation as the deadly fighting in the northern Ethiopia between regional forces and the federal government now spills over an international border. Trove of a sarcophagi, unearthed in Egypt. More than 100 intact sarcophagi have been unearthed near Cairo, dating back more than 2,500 years. The latest finding comes just over a month after the archaeologists in the area found 59 other well-preserved and sealed wooden coffins. Algeria's approved new constitution after referendum. Algerians have approved constitutional reforms in the referendum, though with a record low turnout, the country's constitutional council has announced. The referendum held on November 1st was widely seen as the government's maneuver to neutralize the Hirak protest movement, which had called for a boycott of the plebiscite. Racism and propaganda. Africans in China complain of discrimination in the time of COVID. Africans in China have complained of harassment, discrimination, and even eviction while being accused of carrying the coronavirus since early April. Now, on to Kenya. Kenya named Africa's top tourist destination in 2020. Kenya is Africa's 2020 leading tourist destination. This is according to the World Travel Association, which made the announcement during the inaugural African Winners' Day. In the World Travel Awards, which were also presented, Kenya Tourism Board was named the best tourism board in the continent. That is it for today. Please stay tuned for more.
Anglo poisoning of Zambians.
Widespread lead poisoning from a mine operated by a London-based multinational mining company has recently attracted attention after a legal action by Zambians.
Anglo-American PLC is being sued in a court in South Africa for its operation of the mine in the northern Zambian city of Kabwe from 1925 to 1974. The remnants of the mine are still poisoning many today.
When we come for work, we protect ourselves by putting our home attires in bags or plastics and then wear work clothes. We leave our work clothes here and bath and then change into clothes which we go home in. We also drink milk as a protective measure after work.
Now, a group of Zambian women and children have filed a suit to seek justice for generations of children poisoned by widespread lead contamination from the Kabwe mine in the soil, dust, water, and vegetation.
Represented by 13 plaintiffs in the Johannesburg court, around 100,000 people are demanding not just compensation, but also a cleanup of the area.
One question would be, how did Anglo operate that led to such a disaster? We have Mr. Abayomi Azikwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire and the co-founder of the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice. We ask him to tell us more on that.
The system was designed to extract as much natural resources from Zambia, which was formerly known as Northern Rhodesia, and to pay the African workers slave wages. They did not care about the health and safety of the people there. And it's quite interesting now, since the independence of South Africa and the ANC has come to power, that Anglo-American no longer has its headquarters in Johannesburg. They moved to London right after the ANC took power.
Today, more than 76,000 people live in lead-contaminated areas of Kabwe, amounting to two-thirds of the population there.
Originally known as Broken Hill, the mine became a source of poisonous lead leaking from its smelter, ore processing, and tailing dams.
Now we are joined by Mr. Karavanos. Sir, you've been to Kabwe. How serious is the situation there?
Well, I've been to dozens of toxic places on the planet in many, many countries. And Kabwe stands out for a number of reasons. One is the extent of contamination. The soil level is contaminated with lead from historic mining at very, very high levels. But that's not enough. The second issue is the people living there are readily involved with lead in the sense that they're always touching it, living on top of it, breathing it. So we have very high exposure. We measured lead in soil. We measured lead in blood of the children. We also tested some pilot remediation, meaning solutions. What's a fast, cost-effective way to fix the problem? And we did find very, very high levels of lead. For example, lead in soil is commonly measured, and the unit is 400 parts per million. Well, we measured lead in soil right in people's front yard of their homes at levels of 4,000 and 10,000 parts per million.
Lead leak into the local environment was caused due to deficiencies in the design and systems of operation and control of. The multinational company is to blame for two-thirds of the contamination in the area about 60 miles north of the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The world's biggest lead operation did not come to an end until 1994, 20 years after Zambia nationalized lead mining. But what did the government do in the face of such aggression?
Well, they did take action, but it was not adequate. They were faced with an inherited socioeconomic situation in the entire region of Southern Africa. It's important to understand that South Africa, which was a settler, colonial, imperialist system.
I'm a little disappointed in all my travels there and discussions with the ministries that the government hasn't taken a more active role in investigating the harmful effects of lead. It could be that the government is overwhelmed with other issues of health and health care and a variety of issues that affect low and middle income countries. But I'm sometimes disappointed that the government of Zambia is not working more to either move these people out of the contaminated zone or to offer some remediation.
Anglo did nothing, although it was pretty well aware of the risks of lead pollution from the mine and the measures that were required to prevent and address it. Living in lead-contaminated areas has its hazards for the local communities, such as infertility, brain damage, and in some cases, death. Here's a father recounting how his child is dealing with disability to learn due to lead poisoning.
We started seeing changes in her behavior, especially in learning. At school, she started becoming naughty, not listening to us, very dull to school, many other things.
When we come for work, we protect ourselves by putting our home attires in bags of plastics and then wear work clothes. We leave our work clothes here and bath and then change into clothes which we go home in. We also drink milk as a protective measure after work.
The lead pollution is in the soil, where children play, and two-year-olds have the highest level of lead in their blood.
Some young children even have levels more than 20 times higher than the U.S. threshold.
This is while there is no level of lead exposure that is known to be harmful without effects.
It's the world capitalist system that is responsible. They did not take into consideration the health and well-being of the masses of people who lived in these areas, who worked for these large multinational corporations. And it's not just in Africa. We have the same problem in the United States. Lead poisoning, particularly among children, is a major health hazard in many urban areas throughout the United States.
Anglo-American has stated that it will defend its position vigorously in the court. This is while its human rights policy headline states that where we have caused or contributed to adverse human rights impacts, we will contribute to their remediation as appropriate. So how will the lawsuit go, and what can be done to save the region?
Yes, it's my judgment that it's virtually impossible to say that the owners and the operators of the mine had no idea this was such a dangerous material. Again, we're talking 1960s, 70s, 80s. Lead is very well established. So it's, I think, a little silly to think that we didn't know that this was a dangerous material and that we didn't know what we were doing was harming people. So I think that's extremely naive. And I think maybe the lawsuit and the subsequent court investigation will come to that conclusion.
This is not the first time the multinational is being sued in Africa.
In 2018, Anglo and five other companies paid about $390 million to settle a class action by former gold miners suffering from the respiratory disease silicosis.
Now today, Anglo American PLC is based in the UK, but the lawsuit was filed in South Africa because of the time of the mine's operation. It was headquartered in Johannesburg.
According to the class action lawsuit, Anglo had a duty of care to protect existing and future generations of residents of Kabwe, and it is liable for sustainable emissions of lead into the local environment. The 13 representative plaintiffs include children with very high blood lead levels.
Previous studies have indicated that we have a number of children whose blood lead levels are higher than 10 micrograms per deciliter, and 10 micrograms per deciliter is a World Health Organization standard that is anticipated. At least if it is below, then at least you know that the children and the adults are going to be in a healthy environment.
And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Till we come back again, it's goodbye from me, Mubarak Kenya.
And goodbye from me, Ikram Ibrahim, and the entire team.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.